We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Lauren Bailey.
And I'm Nick Kane.
And thanks for listening.
Podcast 6 is upon us, Lauren, and it's packed with some goodness. We've got a really special storyteller to come, and you've just come back from Bali. Welcome back.
Yay, thank you.
Tell us about that as a starting point.
Oh, wow. Well, I've been back a couple of weeks,
yep.
But I was in Bali, busy training when we went live with Podcast 5. Golly.
Where to start?
It was fantastic. Such a privilege to be part of such an amazing culture and to have the opportunity to focus on the work. We were doing mask, Balinese dance, Balinese music. The art is really driven by the religion and the culture, and it all ties back into each other.
I love how that was infused by the sounds of it, that you had the culture and the religion into what was your craft as well. It was all infused.
It was great focusing on all these different aspects of the art, and then you fuse it all back into the storytelling. You work for 2 weeks on all the different elements, and then on the last day you're working with text and really embodying that with everything that we'd learnt beforehand. And it was just amazing. And on top of that, I don't know who has been tracking my ambition to climb the larger volcano in Bali, which is how you start the course. But I not only did it at the start of the course, I did it again a few days after I finished the course.
A glutton for punishment. But that's awesome. Up a mountain twice in one trip.
Yes, yes. It's a really challenging sort of personal adventure, I suppose, and makes me want to go and, I don't know, Machu Picchu, here I come.
Yeah, it's the next trip. And what about the rest of the month, Lauren? Have you been up to plenty other than Bali? I'm sure there's some other bits that you've managed to fit in.
I came home, of course, to my new life as a creative professional, which I'm focusing on full time. And I guess just working my way through that. I thought that when I came home, I would have a lot of time on my hands.
Hasn't been the case.
But that hasn't been the case. I've felt so busy, and I think my biggest challenge at the moment has been trying to stop myself from trying to do everything at once.
Yes. Well, the kid in a candy store, if you know what I mean, an acting candy store.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, okay, I've got time, I've got energy. Where do you want me? What can I do? You know, in reality, you actually have to figure out what my routine is going to be from here. I'm used to working my day job and then coming home and working on my acting career in the evening. And it's a hard habit to lose.
It's a different energy too. You get a different energy in that morning if you're really focusing on your craft in the morning versus at night as well.
Exactly, which I was planning on tapping right into. But at the same time, I'm used to working in the evening. So I'll work during the day. I'll tap into this great morning energy and I'll be like, oh, that was fantastic. And then I'll get to the evening and I'll feel like keeping on working. So it's been an interesting challenge for me, but one that I'm quite excited about.
Yeah, I'm excited about hearing over the next couple of months how you transition even further and how it becomes just life.
Yay. So one of the things that I have been working on, I've been working with a wonderful filmmaker, Nora Niasari, on an amazing Iranian film, which she's doing for her VCA Masters. And I've been on set as the acting coach for the kids in the film.
A new role. You did talk about this at the end of the last podcast.
Yeah, we just wrapped on before I came here tonight.
Oh, so this is like your wrap party right now.
Right now.
Good experience?
It was amazing. I've directed before, but this was my debut as an acting coach on film, and the kids were just amazing, and Nora has created really important, beautiful story, and it was such a privilege to look at storytelling from another perspective and to help her realize her artistic vision. I'll put her a link to her website up on our site. Her previous film, 17 Years and a Day, won a Gold Remy Award at the 47th Houston International Film Festival, so she does pretty amazing work.
Fantastic.
And I think Oh, I'm sure there's been other things. Yeah. But let's talk about you.
Yeah. Now it's my turn.
Because I remember in the last podcast, you said, oh, I've got quite a quiet month, Lauren. How did that work out for you?
It just didn't work, Lauren. You know what? When you say that, you go, oh, I need some time to breathe. And you know what happens? The next day, things just start slotting into place, don't they? Things just fill up the month. So I've had a huge month. I've seen a lot of theatre, which I'm excited about too. And I want to share a couple of pieces that I did see. One was a piece that was done by Melbourne Playback, in which we got invited to very kindly.
Them. And I just left, so I missed it.
Yeah. So it was called Restoring Hope. And it was put on in collaboration with the Ethnic Communities Council of Victoria and in partnership with the Multicultural Arts Victoria. But Melbourne Playback Theatre, if you haven't seen any of their work before, is really based around improvised theatre and using the audience, a lot of audience participation. So the whole idea was based around sharing stories from refugees and people helping and affected by the displacement of people fleeing their country and then resettling in Australia. It was interactive. It was really quite confronting early days as well. They were asking a lot of questions about perception of refugees in this country and how the audience felt about that. But the really beautiful thing was they had some refugees actually come up and tell their story. And once they had told their story, the actors then improvised their story. Oh. And it was really, I had goosebumps at some points. And the refugees have been through so much, and to see art being used in a way that was just showcasing a little bit of what they've been through, because you can't even imagine what they've been through. But it was this thing, and it was said a couple of times on the night, this idea of art being able to affect change and inform people. And that's what it was. There was something special going on in that room. It was beautiful.
So, well, I'm so sorry I missed it, but it's actually really interesting that when you talk about this show, this film that Nora's doing is set in a detention centre, and the kids that I'm coaching are, you know, Iranian kids.
Yeah.
They're representing characters that have been here 2 months or 6 months or, you know, and they're in this detention centre, and what is that reality for them? So in a different way, I've been investigating some of the truth of that too.
And sharing that story. I was actually listening to another podcast the other day, and it was all based around this idea of one story. I don't know if you might have heard this podcast. I think it might be a TED podcast. But it was based around this idea of we often only hear one story on things. But often, like in the refugees case, there is multiple stories that make up what the truth actually is. And when you're getting only one story, it can be very easy to be locked into to a certain view. And by hearing multiple stories, I think it widens our view.
And perspective on it, yeah.
And helps us to become accepting as well of
that's
change.
Great. Well, I'd love it if you could track down the link to that.
Yeah, of course, I will.
Podcast, that'd be great. What else happened?
Well, I did go and see Orphans at Q44. So I managed to do a course with Gabby, as we said, at Q44, which is beautiful. And they have a wonderful community over there at Q44. And I went and saw Orphans. Now, the thing about Q44 is they train for around about 8 or 9 months on theatre pieces. So I went and saw this show, and it was just so detailed. Like, you could just see in the actors that it had sunk into their body,
they'd
those
really
characters. Can you imagine having 8 or 9 months to do a show?
It sounds really exciting.
It does, doesn't it, right?
Let's start now.
Yeah. Exactly. So it was really beautiful to be able to see that. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of their other work in the future. I think Spiked Heels is their next show.
And maybe Gabby is someone that we should be talking to at some point.
I think definitely. I mean, she's so on the same page.
She's lovely and such a great teacher and an actor as well.
Yeah. So that'll be one that we'll have to chase down, Lauren. I also filmed a TVC this month. But what I did notice and what I wanted to share with everyone is you learn every time you go on set, don't you? You just learn. And one of my things that I really did notice this time was the process of conserving energy for when you need it. Well, I just think you've got to find your own space. There's a lot going on a set, and you know, there's hair and makeup, there's people doing the lights, there's the director, there's all these people to talk to, and it can be, certainly at the start of the day, very exciting to meet everyone and talk. But you can find after 2 hours or 3 hours of that, your energy just drains, and usually, as an actor, you're not shooting in the first 2 to 3 hours that you're there. So making time to spend a little bit of time by yourself and just conserve for when you actually need the energy for the job. So that was something that I just wanted to note. I did do a lovely workshop with Chinsia Kowasan too, from Christine King Casting, and I want her as one of our storytellers as well. Yeah. She's an actor, also obviously in the casting world now, but she's got some beautiful takes and so sharing with her knowledge as well. And it's really lovely to see a casting agent who has that acting background that can help you get to the right spot in a casting. That's me. Woo.
Well, it certainly has been exciting times, and we'll talk some more after the podcast about what's coming up this month. Mm-hmm. But what an exciting interview we have got for you guys. Goodness. I hope you're ready because we cover a lot in this interview. Of course, our storyteller this month is the wonderful, wonderful Natasha Pincus.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get right into it. Here we go. Okay, we are here tonight with writer, director, editor, and all-round filmmaker, Natasha Pincus.
Hi, Natasha. How are you going?
At the Astor Theatre.
We are at the Astor, you're right. So thank you to the Astor, first of all, for hosting us, because it's such a great location. But you talked about this being your spiritual home. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
This is a place that my dad took me to regularly in my adolescent years, and we go regularly still, but it's got kind of an imprinting for me as being a place of cinematic education, all-round relaxation, until recently, there was a feline friend who used to walk around here and join me.
The cat passed, unfortunately.
For 18 years, cat sat on my lap during films. I used to come like 2 or 3 times a week.
It's been a huge influence for your art then, hasn't it? Like huge.
Yeah. To my whole person. Well, and when it's been under threat in some years since then, I've said the following statement and I believe it. If the Astor goes, I go.
Oh, wow. Follow Don't go cat. Anywhere, Astor.
Okay, so normally at the top of our interview, Natasha, we would get our guests to read a story that sums up their journey so far as a storyteller.
Yeah, so, I mean, your response got us thinking, because we said to you, can we have a little bit of a story in a short little 200 words about your life? And you wrote us back a long email going, I'm not sure I can do this. Do you want to take us through really quickly why?
I suppose being a writer, we interrogate things, everything, especially when they relate to ourselves. And it was the use of the word story that stuck with me. If it was like, can you send me a 200-word bio?
Yeah.
And I've got some of those kind of like
loaded, ready to go.
Which is interesting in itself because a bio is not what we're after.
Right.
No.
It's something about the essence of you as a person.
Well, I suppose I wrote something back which was intuitive at the time.
Yeah.
I can't remember what I wrote.
You did talk about your story and that to write that as it stands now, it's constantly evolving and changing, and to get that into 200 words is just not possible.
It's not even the word limit. I think it was also about the impulse to do that.
Yeah.
To something personal.
Where it was driven from. Okay.
Because it's intimate.
Yeah.
It's emotionally intimate. So it was confronting.
It certainly says so much to me about your relentless investigation of life and what drives us as storytellers. And I just want to quote something you did write in your email because I think it's really lovely about how our story is constantly unraveling and evolving. We are always in a mixed process of its experience and its commentary.
You kind of did tell us a little bit about your story. That's why I love that sort of intro that we've just given you, because it does tell us a little bit about you in your own little way.
So let's start at the beginning then.
Of your story.
Page one.
Yes, you think you got out of it.
Yeah.
And so through discussion, we can examine some of the challenges that you've faced so far and what continues to provide the need to communicate stories about the human experience.
So here we go. So according to our research, you grew up in Melbourne. Is that correct? Yeah, great.
Pretty much in this spot.
Well, I mean, we've talked about the Astor, but were there any other creative influences or, you know, artistic influences you had in your childhood?
I suppose some of them you remember and some kind of get told back to you. I guess part of that storytelling thing.
Yeah.
That, like, your story is also not just yours, it's everyone else's version of you, which becomes like an ongoing, multifaceted narrative. Sidebar. But yeah, like, I think creatively, I've been inspired by all sorts of different things. I love cinema as one thing, but I'll be just as inspired by a random person walking down the street or an animal or a relationship I have with a strange dog that ran away from home or the light that falls on a windowsill. I mean, it's just all completely the same things that inspired me then inspire me now. And Melbourne's good for that because winter is so relentless. I hate it so much that it puts me in a position of suffering.
You hate it so much you love it.
I hate it more than anything. There's no love. I appreciate how much time it gives me to work without distraction.
Yeah.
Wow.
Other than that, I hate it. I have seasonal affective disorder.
Okay.
That's self-diagnosed.
Yeah, self-diagnosed.
And just a really good excuse to stay in bed.
But it's interesting. What it is, I think, is, you know, to me, like, I like winter for 5 minutes and then I don't like it. And I thought about why this is, obviously, investigating.
Mm.
And it's because, like, the sensory experience is deadened. Like, I mean, there's only one note. It's, like, a really, really, really strongly, like, a strong chili dish. I don't really get it because it's, like, there's no layers.
You've just
got the spicy. There's nothing else going on. And winter is the same. It's just, like, it's one note. I mean, it is cold. I am burying myself against. I'm putting on my stuff. I'm resisting experience.
Yeah.
And being a writer, you're sensory and you're kind of, like, stimulated by the range of possible sounds, smells and other things.
I just love the idea that seasons have atmospheres though. So for winter for me, it has an, you turn inward and it has more of a romantic or a somber or a moody atmosphere.
And does this sound weird, but warmth as well? Like we spend a lot of time inside next to a fire, there's the warmth
accessing
of winter.
Warmth.
Yeah, accessing warmth. Yeah, seeking it.
Yeah, I'm always seeking it. Yeah. Like even in like 35 degree day, I want more.
Warm-blooded.
I love it. I like warm. And I guess I just like the smells of summer, and I like I like just, I guess, all the behaviours that are so presentful and tactile and you know, sensory and in the moment. Because to me, like writing especially is so cerebral and so imaginative, and you're like lucid dreaming all the time that you want to get back in your body. And I don't want to get back in my body when that body is in a cold place.
So
in a warmer environment, I kind of oscillate between something completely imaginary and something completely overwhelmingly
too real. Yeah. Well, let's talk about what else you seek. Can you remember when you first became interested in the arts, or what drew you to having a career like this?
Yeah, well, I suppose they're different in a way, the career versus the arts themselves. I think I resisted the career element as long as I possibly could. In fact, most of my behaviours would show an overabundance of resistance because of all the kind of practical, logical, rational and reasons not to go this way.
Does that include the science and law degree?
No, because they're not the arts to me. I mean, I guess, you mean doing them was existence? Yes, I suppose. Well, no. I guess that was, I feel like, part of my personal education.
Yeah. You know,
it was part of my character building.
Okay.
Like, want to experience the world, let's learn that stuff.
Yeah.
And I have so many things that if life went on forever and I had more brain cells, I would put more things in there.
Explore another dimension of yourself.
I mean, I was just reading the other day, Kurt Vonnegut's, God, I sound pretentious when I say this, but he did his final interview. I don't know, it's actually interesting to walk sidebar because it's not his final interview. There's a series of interviews that ends with his final interview, but it's the relationship of those previous interviews to the final interview, which is the narrative. Fascinating. Anyway.
Right.
You'd get along well with our first storyteller.
Oh, right.
Yes, yeah.
Because Kurt's his favourite writer.
Okay. Well,
been mentioned on the podcast before.
Fascinating. Well, I've read all of his books, I've only read a couple, but him as a person is more interesting. He became an artist at the end of his life, like a drawer. But in the thing, he was talking about how he was an anthropologist and a scientist and like how that prepared him or not for being an artist. And in it was interesting to me. Like, I'd love to do anthropology. But who's got like
who's
those?
Who's got the time?
Life, you know, like so. Science and law. I don't know if today I could open that box, but because you've got the kind of like buoyancy of youth and the feeling of timelessness and you can just live on forever, that I went, oh, I'll do that for 7 years.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Why not?
Explore that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it just felt like the right thing to do. But I guess I've always felt the first pangs of art. I mean, art, that's a whole other conversation about artists because self-labelling oneself as an artist is a fraught endeavour, especially in Australia. So I think I'm still grappling with that. And I don't even know if I would have used that word in my 200-word story if I'd written one.
We'll
never know. Oh, maybe I wrote it and just didn't share it.
Talking about labelling, about labelling.
Labels are interesting.
IMDb says you've got some acting credits.
Oh, God. You know what's really interesting is like literally today or was it yesterday, time is confusing. My agent, who's also like the most amazing person on the planet, she told me, she emailed me saying, okay, we've been trying like anything to get these acting credits on your IMDb. How do we do this? I'm like, I don't know. I've been trying to keep it a secret.
And isn't there a form you can fill out
on IMDb? Yeah, you can fill out
a form. They refuse to take them down.
Oh.
And it's like, I'm trying to remove this from my story.
Yeah. You can't remove things from your story,
you? Well, this is part of the problem, right? I mean, this is it. Well, although theoretically, as you rephrase it, you select to take out or omit to put in.
Yeah.
Reshapes the narrative.
But it still
it's
shapes
like a
rewrite, surely.
You know?
At the end of the story.
Maybe I'm making it into a horror. I'm making it into a romantic comedy.
Well, let's continue
on
this.
Yes, there was acting. Okay, short answer. There was.
Yes.
I was young. I didn't know. I blame my parents. I was like 15.
Yeah, there's a soundbite for you.
It was good money. What do you want? It was time off school. It was educational. And what it did do, I guess, because I don't have any family in the arts, quote unquote, or in the film industry, it made filmmaking and the environment of filmmaking normal. Because it was an environment that I grew up in. Like, you know, like you get your parents' bakery. If they're a bakery, you always, they're after smells of freshly baked bread, bring back positive feelings of youth.
Yeah.
Now I get that around film sets because during those formative years I was on film sets.
It was
so
good feel.
Even though I was acting on the side of the camera, like I knew what a grip and a gaffer were when I was a kid, which is cool.
Step above most people, isn't it, at that age? So,
it just becomes natural.
Yeah.
You know, it was never this thing of being 21 and learning something at that age. It just was part of my vernacular and language from pretty much 11 I started, so...
Wow.
Yeah.
So some other labels we could hit you up with.
Uh-oh.
Writing, directing, acting, editing, filmmaking.
Vegetarian.
How...
Vegetarian, good.
Vegetarian.
Vegan curious.
love it. Yeah.
How do you... Well, this may be the answer. How do you perceive or think about yourself when you wake up in the morning?
Oh, usually like, why does everything hurt so much?
Why is it so cold?
Why is everything so hard?
Yeah. God damn you, Melbourne. Yeah, I've got this fancy mattress, but I'm convinced it's killing me. Anyway.
Wow.
Every morning I wake up and go, how could this be so expensive and make me feel so sore in the morning? So how do I perceive myself in the morning? It depends. And I think this is, you know, not to be a politician evading the question, but sidebarring everywhere. There's something kind of interesting about the fact that when I'm in writing mode, of which is only one of the modes that is kind of a reality for me, it's really hard to get your cues from anything. And it sounds super pretentious and indulgent, but I'll share with you a little bit about my rituals around this. I think my thing I do in the morning when I'm writing is specifically not thinking about myself. In fact, I say to Warwick, my partner, and he gets kind of shitty, but he's dealing after 7 years. He's getting a hang of it. He's like, I know this is going to sound really pretentious, but when I'm in writing mode, like, I just don't do talking or anything in the mornings at all, because I'm like in this dreamlike state where my completely blank slate. And from that, I'm pretty much going to go straight into the work. Mm. And if all of a sudden, even if you look at me, I am now me. Right? Yes, I'm no longer a conduit. I am like,
as it changes the lens.
In myself.
Yeah.
I'm in my lane. I'm in my body. I'm in my world. I'm in the relationships I have and everything else. So the short answer is, most mornings when I'm working, I wake up and I'm none of my labels. I'm trying actively not to have any of them, because I just want to be as kind of blank as possible.
It's interesting, isn't it? I do feel that too, as a performer as well. If I've got any kind of audition or we're filming that particular day, that morning
That's
needs to be my own.
Yeah.
And by that I mean I need to tune out of what's going on around me
to
get in the position that I can actually go and do my work.
When I was
so
an
I totally
actor,
get it.
I used to always wear the same thing to my auditions. And
really?
It was like a uniform that I'd learned was my blankness, which was at the time blue jeans, black t-shirt.
Yeah.
And I know it sounds like a cliche, but
no, you need to have those rituals.
Yeah. Like lucky undies, isn't it? Like everyone has a pair,
I don't
right?
know, is it?
No?
Nick,
okay.
Tell us about your lucky undies.
No, I don't have a pair.
It's usually lucky.
Sidebar.
Sidebar, as we like to say.
It's usually really lucky when you're not wearing any. I've been told, I hear. But yeah, blank canvas is what it's at.
Great. Yep. And let's talk about your work as a filmmaker as well. What was the first project that got you in as a filmmaker?
Technically speaking, it would be like just, you know, obviously amateur stuff you do.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's not with an operative video camera, my dad gave me a stills camera to play with when I was 4, actually. Like, it's a kind of Kodak film
Fantastic.
Camera. And I carried that with me everywhere I went. And having that on me kind of fitted me with my personal lens of life. Like, it was just like, you know, everything looked like a possible shot.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was like almost my first engagement with what it would be like to convert what I experience and see and perceive to share with others through a medium like film, in that case, 35mm film. And Dad's a pharmacist and he had his own pharmacy, so we'd still have to wait 24 hours, as you used to have to do, but like, we'd put it in an envelope and we'd send it off and I'd sit there, wait for the envelope to come back with my pictures in it, and that was very exciting.
A question about that too is, I was speaking to a filmmaker the other day about who's now 80-odd, and he was saying how different it was when you actually had to use reel and how much people appreciated the reel so much more than the digital space that we now have.
It's different.
Did you feel that back then of like waiting 24 hours to get those photos was like...
And shooting as well, the film. I mean, my first music video was on 35mm. My first short film was on 16mm. I always said my first feature would be on film. And as it takes longer and longer for me to get the dang thing up, it's seeming less and less a possibility. But there's nothing like... There's something they say about having film on set elevates performance, because it just, you know, the actors can hear that noise.
You know how important it puts an extra level of importance on it. Yeah.
Definitely. I think it's really irreplaceable. I mean, it definitely has some sort of magic about it. I know I sound like my age when I say how much I love film, like I love the Aster and so on. But look, digital suits certain projects where you can, you know, do the spray and pray approach. You just shoot a whole lot of stuff and see what worked. But for me, there's nothing like shooting on film and nothing like seeing a film that's been shot on film. I'm an absolute bunny for it. I love it.
Well, let's talk about that process. I'm going to skip around here a little bit, because you do mention two techniques that you like to use, and one of them is spray and pray, isn't it? And the other one is precision.
There's pretty much the two extremes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, is that noticeable?
And we were just saying as well that maybe the law degree, the precision thing comes from the science and law degree a little bit, that side of your brain maybe. And the spray and pray is a bit more creative.
The rational, intuitive question, conundrum thing.
Yep.
You know, it's funny, I think we spend our whole lives not just writing our stories but developing awareness or exploration of our process. Yep. And I don't mean that just about art, I mean that about life. Like, You can take it into the pragmatic, like what sort of toothpaste do I like, or how am I going to conduct myself in relationships, or how do I like to make art? And for me, now a few years into my practice, I'm still absolutely none the wiser. I'm actually more aware of my own contradictions than ever. And they are exactly that. They're halfway between, they're exactly half of, I just love having broad parameters to experiment and have freedom for magic to emerge. And, you know, have a big enough bottle to catch the lightning versus let's just plan this to the nth bloody degree. I mean, you know, I admire Kubrick and I admire, like, you know, his precision and the framing and the planning is sublime. But then I don't really have the patience or I hate doing that. I hate working like that. Yeah. But I respect it.
It's really interesting, though. I think it's the same, I don't know about how you feel, Nick, but as an actor, you're on set and you need to connect to something. Mm-hmm. And I use a lot of I'm all about the imagination. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. But if you need to get into something, you're like, oh, I'm going to use a bit of sense memory, or I'm going to, you know, you use whatever tools you need to use.
Correct.
You don't stop and think, oh, no, that's not my process.
No. That's, you know.
Yeah, you've got, exactly, but it depends on the content, right?
Mm.
I mean, obviously, like, and in an actor sense, who you're playing with, who the players are and what the scene is and everything. When it comes to being an originator of the material, it's a bit more complex because, not more complex, it's a bit different because... Like, sometimes you can become aware of yourself censoring yourself. Well, this is something I'm just becoming aware of.
Yeah.
Censoring yourself at the very inception stage because maybe the premise that you've just come up with in a lightning bolt moment for a film might be, oh, that's a great story I want to tell. But you don't go that way because, or even to explore it, because you know that that is going to pattern you into a pathway of working, of thinking that might not be what you're suited to or what you feel like doing right now. And this is something that I'm actually confronted with in my project Clive, which is my baby. It's a film I've wanted to... It's the film, if I only get to direct one, will be this one.
This is the one that got on the Hollywood blacklist in 2012.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, it's almost like it's like the absolute inciting incident into my own personal exploration of my own conundrums. Because it is of itself like halfway. You could execute it entirely intuitively or entirely rationally. And one of the reasons I put the brakes on its production was because the decision to...
Which way to go?
Was so confronting to me at an identity level or in a personal... bigger question about myself that I didn't know what to do, so I just ran away.
To say that you did that is in its own, it needs courage, you know what I mean? Because most people go, oh no, it just wasn't, you know.
Yeah, well, I only opened it for the first time in 18 months, 3 days ago, so I'm in a dark place.
So we've met you at a very interesting time in the depths of winter.
Yeah.
In a dark, dark
room. My least favourite season, with my least favourite part of my process. But at least it's my favourite place.
Yes.
It is interesting, though, because like I thought, in a way, I think unconsciously, I thought, okay, I'll just let time manage this. And by the time I get some sort of distance from the piece, I'll know myself better, I'll have developed as a filmmaker more, I'll have crystallised my methods a little better.
Yeah.
And it has not happened. I mean, all that's happened is I've changed or evolved, but I'm just different. Doesn't mean I'm any clearer. I'm just 18 months bloody older.
Yeah.
Mind you, opening the script was confronting. I looked at it and went, whoa, this is crap. So, you know, maybe I have my craft sets but got better.
Yeah.
But I still don't know the essential question, the answer to the question of how I want to execute it.
Do you think that the answer to that, before you started working on feature films, you did a lot of work on music videos and in short film. They're much smaller projects in one sense, but are every bit as important. And from what we've read about you and from your work that we've seen, your music videos are beautiful.
Is there something
about the way you answer those smaller questions that you think could provide the answer for this much larger question?
The only difference is, I think, is that in music video you can commit to one particular kind of methodology, as you say. They're very complicated and condensed, but their beginning, middle and end process is a lot shorter and less of a financial and time commitment than a feature film. So you can almost experiment with your own process, project to project.
Risk.
This one's going to be really precise. I'll just suck that up for a little while and get through it. And then, this is intuitive, and I'll just suck that up for a while. You know, when it comes to feature film as well, there's so much kind of, I guess, emphasis and import place on you, even especially in Australia, your first feature.
Yeah.
What's you gonna? This is what you sound like. If you could put all of who you are into one product, it would look like this. So you don't. You kind of have to, you know, pick every little bit of you and try and make sure you've picked the truest parts of you. Or feed them all into just that one cinematic moment. It doesn't feel like one of a big body of work. I've done 20 videos. I'm never going to make 20 features. So each one has got a lot more kind of emotional space it has to occupy and justify in itself. So I guess, theoretically, you're right. Like, I could just kind of follow that cue, but every one of my videos has been so different in the way that I've done them. I didn't really learn anything more about what I want to do. I just get the idea that I think would be right for that video, a song, and then I would have to find the skill set to execute it. That was kind of the process, you know.
What was the first foray into music videos for you? What was the first video?
Paul Kelly.
Paul Kelly got Tommy Too.
Yeah,
great. How was the experience? Sorry, you're laughing.
Yeah, it's great. I love when you say you work and you're laughing.
No. Because
should I say why I'm laughing? Yes. Because when I was putting together the initial research for this interview, the piece of text I grabbed had "God told me to" in caps lock, and I just copied the text, and it's still like that in the question. So every time I read the question, "You worked with Paul Kelly on God told me to.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So that's why she had a little giggle. Exactly.
I should probably keep these things in my head.
Yeah. This is good. I'll always hear it that way. Fantastic. Well, "God told me to" was my debut in music video land.
And working with Rock Royalty there too.
I mean, just royalty full stop.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Australian royalty. Yeah.
I mean, if there was a God, it would be pretty much PK, wouldn't it?
Paul Kelly told you to, yeah.
I get it. I mean, he is one in a gazillion, that dude.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, that was, threw yourself into an intimidating, ambitious circumstance like that. I mean, not because of him by any means, but because of my own self-pressure to succeed.
Yep.
You sort of have this pressure of, I mean, Paul Kelly really is one out of the box, but when you've got someone who is in the Hall of Fame, I mean, I don't just mean literally, but like in people's hearts, you know at the moment that no matter, even if your work sucks, that it's also by association going to be imported into that hall.
Yeah.
So like there's also the immortality. Like a lot of stuff can disappear into the ether, but as soon as like there's any retrospective of his work, all of a sudden it's there. The pressure of that alone, aside from the personal pressure of working with an idol of mine and also just wanting to launch myself properly into the music video world and all those things, was immense. Like it was crazy. Yeah. If I'd known all those things at a conscious level, I probably wouldn't have been able to do it. But I mean, I just kind of blindly powered through. And when I look back, we had a very low budget. We shot on 35mm film, which at the time, by the way, digital was available already. But I just had this idea that we were going to do that on one shot video. And we only had enough budget for 8 takes. And I can only develop, I think, 3 of them or 2 of them.
Oh.
So, yeah. Yeah. So,
no pressure. It's just gone high.
What was I thinking?
It's a high pressure now, isn't it?
I wish I'd made my feature that day because, I mean, I would have had the gumption to go past. I wouldn't have overthought it the way that I'm overthinking. Yeah. As you get older, you know, you get more tired, obviously more sore in the body in the mornings. And and generally speaking, you've
got to get a new mattress.
We've got to do an interview with you in summer, don't we? We're right in the middle.
Yeah. I'm worried, but it's beautiful. It's so comfortable. I get into bed, I'm like, oh, nice mattress. I love this bed. And I wake up and go, oh, you bed, you evil bed. You heard me again. Damn you, latex.
I do want to talk a bit about a quote that you said too, because I think it comes nicely off that Paul Kelly.
Oh, I wanted to read
you
this
read
quote.
It out. It's yours.
I love this quote.
Oh, dear.
You said previously that you regard working on music videos. Is this the quote you were
reading?
Yeah. Yep. That you get delivered an experience that is one little light bulb moment in another person's heart.
Oh, did I say that?
Yeah, that's well done.
I think that's beautiful.
Yeah.
This work's clearly really important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Was music videos your in? Were you initially drawn to that idea of visualising an artist song?
Yeah.
There was a kind of like, I guess, a kind of lucky combined chaos of all that. I mean, feature film was always the goal or dream, I suppose. I mean, I love film. However, I love music. I mean, I love music. And in fact, in some ways, music's a much more pure art form. I actually hate film as a process. I think it's really inelegant.
As much as winter?
More than up 100 there. Winters.
Up there.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean,
filmmaking is inelegant. It is collaborative poo. I mean, you know what? I mean, I can take some of that collaborative out. I don't need all that collaborative. There's like 1,000 people there. It's like decision-making by committee. It's expensive. It takes forever. I get really tired. You know, like it's gross.
Yeah.
If I could be a painter, I'd be a painter. Right? But I can't be a painter.
Is this advice to the young filmmakers out there?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, I'll keep this up. I'm not in love with process. I think people who say they are either deluded or they're lying.
Yeah.
So no, I don't like filmmaking. However, music is pure. Music is a direct communication from like it's a universal language. It's from your spirit to your fingers to someone else's ears into their spirits. It's beautiful. So I've always kind of been fascinated in accessing or touching that closer. You know, like producing music is great, but it's still not enough. You've got to have more.
Yeah.
So creating an image from music is almost like the ultimate intimacy with that. Because you hear it as a filmmaker in a way, even the musician themselves has never heard it. Because you're like interrogating
it. Well, you're translating it, aren't you, into a different medium. Yeah.
You're eating it up and then making it and regurgitating, making it a new meal. It's awesome.
Yeah.
But my point is that, like, I guess there was a kind of divine positive around the fact that I love music. It wasn't, though, if it had been many years earlier, maybe it wouldn't have happened, because what happened in 07 was a really good timing for me to take music video on as a craft, because it was a happening thing for the first time in years.
Yeah.
So it was timing as well. Like, you know, Spike Jonze and Chris Cunningham and Michelle Gondry, they all just like pioneered this new way of seeing music in their videos.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to be on that.
I want to do that.
Wagon. Yeah. I want that in Australia, mate.
Well, that is a question, because it's like, let's talk about your form now as how you translate either music videos or whatever. But you've quoted as saying as well, you use puppetry, animation, thermal imaging, underwater therapy, is it?
Imagery?
Not therapy, that's random. And a lot of like fake blood.
Yeah, fake blood.
Love it, do you? That's one of your things.
Fake
but
blood, yeah.
The form and...
Hates filmmaking, loves fake blood.
That's got to be a bit of fun, though, thinking about the form.
Come on, they get the weirdest stuff.
Yeah.
Look, at the same time, I don't want to be like a, you know, a music video or any kind of artist that, you know, has a mixed lolly bag of work. So it's not like a... Form doesn't lead the idea.
No.
It's like I'm not sitting there going, oh, that's a cool trick.
Yeah, this is cool, let's do this.
Definitely not. Like, I don't do any of that kind of stuff. But what I tend to be drawn to doing... is, like I said, I don't like the process so much, so I've got to be pretty compelled to do it. And it has to fascinate me. Once I've had the idea that I love for a video, it becomes so painful to keep it in. Like, I can't, it drives me completely mad. Like, I just kind of, it's like I can't see it. It's right there in my head, but I can't see it yet.
Yeah.
And then, and that idea has to be so fascinating and actually also warrant all that work to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I can't be bothered. I can't justify the time away from my family. I can't justify the painful hours of lack of sleep or the financial ruin for something that's a bit meh. So ultimately, the thing that ends up getting me excited, aside from being an amazing song, has to be something that provides an inventive step in some way in the medium.
Yep.
That's been harder and harder for me to achieve the last few years, because people are just all of a sudden, it's just everywhere. And at the beginning, I felt like I had something to contribute. And nowadays, I kind of feel a little bit like, if I don't do it, someone else will. I don't feel as much... maybe room, because the availability of the medium is so widespread. People are just chucking all sorts of videos together, and innovation is a dirty word right now. So I've stopped for a while. I want to keep doing it. And to be honest, the other side has been a lot of songs have been submitted to me, even though after the Gorgie video there were billions of them. Most of them were pretty meh. And I just weren't doing one for a song.
No.
That makes me feel like that, because if it feels like that in the song, the pictures won't look anything better than that.
Nah. Yeah, well, that's right. And content creation too, you were talking about that. So much out there now. People are always going to create things on their iPhone and all that type, but it's allowed more people to create. Do you reckon it's going to make it even more important that the people who are the actual storytellers to really tell good stories in that?
Yeah, cutting through, for sure. I mean, look, it's no different than when TV came out. Oh, God, TV's going to kill the radio, and the internet killed TV and all these different things. We've seen this all before.
Yeah.
Just because everyone can write with a pen and paper doesn't mean everyone can write a good story. You think that the limiting thing is the availability of tools. It's got nothing to do with it. The availability of resources hasn't really ever been in question when it comes to creation of art. There has to be inspiration and perspiration.
And often limitation.
And limitation.
Limitations can bring out sides to your art.
Absolutely. And that's the thing is, like, the more tools you have, sometimes I always often see these filmmakers who make these amazing films in low budget, and then they get all the toys and their works like
weak.
It happens, not all the time, but because sometimes it's like the worst thing that possibly can happen to you is getting what you want. I mean, careful what you wish for. So I think that'll always be. People call themselves editors because they can use Final Cut. People call themselves writers because they can write the phone book. I mean, you're a writer because you're telling a story and you're creating a world with people. I think that's the same irrespective of what the tool is you're using.
Can we talk about, I think you just mentioned it.
Was that we've
written it down as the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
For those of our listeners that aren't already aware, Natasha, through the company she co-founded, Stark Raving Productions, was involved in concept, direction, production and editing of the iconic video for Gautier's worldwide hit, Somebody That I Used to Know, which she will now sing for us. Which won the ARIA Award 2011 and was nominated for the MTV's VMA for Best Video. The video has been viewed over 500 million times on YouTube.
That's a fair whack, isn't it? And you've talked a lot about this in interviews, and people refer to this as your big turning point. But you're the only one that doesn't talk about it as your big turning point. I want to explore that. What did it mean for you? All of a sudden,
overnight
you were
success.
Wanted and you're overnight success and you're going and doing this and Clive and, you know, all these things. But what did it mean? Because you don't think of it like that, do you?
No, well, Clive was before that.
It
was kind of... Look, it was a bit of a really magical triangulation of things that happened that same year. The Gautier video came out exploded the same year that I was on the Hollywood Blacklist with Clive,
yep.
which was a script I'd written 2 years earlier and had just started pushing, and it just happened to coincide, which is when Fell got funded, which is a feature that I wrote. Mm. Got,
which just yep. screened yeah, at Sydney Film Festival.
Yeah, so that was all like the three things that were happening at once. So yeah. I think there was an explosive effect because of all of those things happening. Yeah. Turning points either way, even with the explosion, not really. It meant that lots of people maybe would take you seriously faster. That's the only thing.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that happens. Like, I mean, you always got these opinions and they're yours to keep.
Yeah.
And most people look at you with a sort of half-arched eyebrow, especially when you look, like I tend to wear hoodies and jeans and sneakers, and I tend to kind of be pretty casual, and also I'm female, so no offence, but I'm not like, you know, too gender imbalanced here, but most of the time people go, yeah, you're smart. I don't know if I believe you or not. Like, the prima facie response is, you could just be an idiot. But as soon as, like you say, you know, as soon as you're legitimised by yeah. something like that,
yeah.
they only say that after you've met you, not at the beginning. Like, it gives you just a bit more kudos, I guess, about, it hasn't changed my opinions no. or who I'm sitting opposite by with, but it tends to maybe affect the balance of power a little bit in the meetings, and that's useful. Practically, I live in the same apartment, I have the same car, everything's the same. Yeah. And I was getting, the thing is, like, because the Paul Kelly video was a really boutique video and it was successful, I was kind of, the only thing that ever limited how many videos I made a year or for whom were me. I was lucky in the sense that never, that was never been an issue. And yeah. after the Gortier video, all that happened, I got more and more songs sent, but I chose just as few.
Was there a confidence in your voice that started to then go, you know what, this is a bit of a...
I've always had that about yep. videos because, like good. I said, I mean, it's not a confidence so much as a kind of, I don't need to be doing this right now, mm. is the arrogance I have about it. It's like, I don't need this. I have to want to do this. And sometimes you get a song like an artist you love, like yeah. you go, wow, I've always wanted to meet that person or work with them, and finally one day that artist sends you a song, you might not get that song. You just don't get it.
Yeah.
You just don't, I mean, you might love it even, but you just can't imagine a video, or it doesn't just make for good video. And then you've got to say no. And I do. I've always said no as my first response to everything. And that's true of anyone and everything. I say no, and then I have to be one over.
Convince
to say
yourself,
yes.
yeah,
that I have it's to be really convinced.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
the most powerful thing you can ever say is no.
This brings up something really interesting for me, which is the idea of your voice. I initially heard you talk at Friday on My Mind at AFTERS earlier in the year.
Oh yeah.
At the end, a lot of people were asking questions, and I didn't get time to ask something that I was interested in. Mm. You were talking about the music videos that you'd worked on and collaborating with artists and some of the stuff that we've touched on here. But for me, the real question is, what is your sense of your voice as an artist? Is that something that's clear to you? Is that something that you're confident with, or that is still evolving?
It's a great question. I think, I don't know. It's one of those things sometimes where you produce something from a true place and then you look back at it and remark, and it looks like it's been written by somebody else. You think, oh, who wrote that? If I was conscious of it, I wouldn't be able to do it, I don't think, in a way. Like, yeah. I couldn't emulate or fake my own voice. But when I read it, I know it's mine. And in fact,
yeah.
it's one of those things, again, like the story thing, because it is that thing that you don't actually ever have your own story, I think. It's only whatever people tell you back is your story. Mm. Well, it's that tree falling in the woods thing kind of thing, in a way. You know, like, you're inside looking out, and so, but it doesn't really actually, you know, what's our evidence that anything ever actually happened? That's why this whole fascination with selfies and stuff, it's like, oh, it's proof. I was actually here. I actually yeah. did breathe in and out, and this is me. I can see it now. But obviously the experience of seeing it changes the experience. So it's like one of those quantum mechanical nightmares. So so the point is, when it comes to things like when it comes to things like, you know, your own voice, it's the same. It's not that different. Like, when you're perceiving what you sound like in your work or what your opinion is or whatever, it's already ruined the creation.
It's already
of it.
In the past.
It's already happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. The reality is, like, people say to me, I saw that film the other day and I was watching it, and halfway through I thought, gee, that looks like something Tash would have done, and it was yours. And I find that eminently interesting. I'm like, what have they tapped into? What is it that they recognise? What is it that's common? You know, and then people watch all my music videos and they say, oh, they're so different, but they're all so the same. They're all so you.
Yeah.
And I interrogate them. What do you mean? What do you mean? Is it the story?
Yeah. What is it?
Are there common things that people describe to you?
They might. I mean, it's interesting that, you know what, the people who are least educated in the academia of filmmaking give you the best answers, because they're the truest answers.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
my dad, for example, seen billions of films, he's incredibly loves cinema, but he has no, like, you know, hasn't read Sid Field or whatever, yeah. thank God. But it's kind of like, you know, like, he speaks so intelligently about film and so honestly. So he would be able to say, and he often says, that's such a Tashi film, he says all the time, even if it's not one I've made. Yeah. And then I grab him by the wrist, like, what do you mean? What do you mean?
Tell me.
Tell me. And he often talks about things that he sees in me, like he talks about humanity, or he'll talk about like emotional intimacy, and he'll talk about that. And even if it's a thermal imagery video or puppetry, there's something about, I guess, in my goal, I guess, would be that I'm always trying to be emotionally truthful about what it means to be a person.
Do you think there's something useful in that knowledge? As actors, we spend a lot of time thinking about our brands or our type. When you're pitching yourself for your work, is that not useful then?
Yeah. It probably is. And it's funny because, again, it comes back to me, like a music, like labels often will say to me, send me stuff and say, oh, we know this is not really your thing, but we thought we'd send it to you. And I'm thinking, what do they think my thing is? Like, what is it that they're talking about?
Yeah.
You know, I mean... And I think that's a kind of in the beholder. Like some people will look at my work and go, oh, it's smart, or oh, it's simple, or oh, it's handmade. Or, you know, I guess that's more actually a comment on the person perceiving it than on the creator of the work, I think.
Let's talk about Hollywood's Blacklist, which for those of our listeners who don't know, is an annual list of the top scripts circulating Hollywood.
And it's a good thing, not a bad thing, despite the sound of the name.
Yeah, because you hear Blacklist, you're like, oh God, never going to get a job in this town.
Yeah. Exactly. Wow, why are they interviewing her?
She must be really bad.
I don't know how many screenplays you'd written before Clive got on the Blacklist, but this must have been pretty exciting for you.
It's probably the biggest thing that's ever happened in my career or any kind of professional life.
Does that include this podcast interview?
Like,
well,
you
this is sort of like setting a new kind of standard.
Yeah, great. That's the answer we would like. Yeah.
Let's say prior to today, prior to this moment in the Astor, the Astor.
Thank you, Astor.
Thank you, Astor. Yes, it was a very big highlight. And it's also, the Blacklist is not something you enter. It's sort of something I would never have hoped for because you can't submit to it or control it. So what happens is Hollywood executives do a secret ballot and they put in their favourite scripts they've read this year that currently haven't yet been made, and then they all get collected and then they publish.
And then your agent contacts you, or you open a magazine one day and
Like, I think it was like 6 a.m. 7 a.m. one morning, a friend of mine in Hollywood actually emailed me and goes, oh my God, like, congrats or whatever. And I was like, what have I won? Have I won like a free set of steak knives? And then all of a sudden he looked down the list and was like all these 15 different congrats.
Does it blow your mind?
Wild. Yeah, look, I had a little taste of it about a year earlier. I did UCLA postgrad kind of remotely online, and they have an annual screenwriting competition. And I entered the script that you write as part of the program.
Yep.
And I'd been a winner of that. And the same thing happened where I woke up in the morning and there was like, next to all the Groupons and all the kind of penis enlargement ads, there was like 1,000 like, you know, congrats things. And I'm thinking, that's a lot of spam that says the same subject. Oh,
what I've been hacked.
I've been hacked, damn it, again. So I'd felt it then, but then this was obviously like, you know, a massive step again. And I think I was a little bit numb because I was kind of still on the Gautier surfing adventure and I was like, oh, come on, man, what else are you gonna give me? And my immediate kind of like Woody Allen voice in my head, which we all have, I'm sure, says, oh God, something bad's gonna come soon. Because all this good stuff's happening, all the bad shit's right around the corner.
happens in threes
I think so, yeah. But so short answer, it was good. It was really, really positive. It was the culmination of being in Hollywood and having a lot of meetings around that script.
So do you have any inkling in the lead up to that? Like, are you getting an idea of the reception of the script, or it's just sort of blanket until something like that happens?
Yeah, look, the script had been really well received. I knew that because I was getting a lot of attention. So the pathway to it was, I guess in a way, the Gautier video maybe was a turning point. I mean, it wasn't as clear as this, but I went to South by Southwest, the music festival, which has a video component, and the video had gotten in there. So I went to that, and on the back of that, I went to LA. And because the video had done very well, my agent here in Australia had set me up to meet with some agents over there. And I guess maybe I wouldn't have gotten in the door with those meetings if they hadn't had that kind of, oh, the Gautier girl? You know, that kind of gave me a reason to get in the room. But when I met with the agents, like, a lot of them wanted me just to go off and do Nike ads and Katy Perry videos, which I wasn't interested in, and only a few of them actually had bothered to read my script as well. And the agent I ended up going with said to me, I love your videos, but I'm really digging your scripts. You're really a better writer even than anything else. So that's when I knew that he was going to really back the script. And you got to have someone like an agent like that to send it out and to get people to read it and set you up with meetings. And then that all sort of snowballed. Whether I meant that was going to have any kind of like Blacklist showing, I had no idea.
And I've got a question, because you did talk about the Nike commercials and all that type of thing. Now, you said that's not what you want. What do you want as a filmmaker?
I want world peace.
Yeah. Good answer. Yeah. Yes.
I don't know.
Sometimes when it hits you, it hits you. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Like, I've just got to be, like I said, like, I guess my default position is no.
Yeah.
So I guess I know what I don't want. It's like, and I guess generally speaking, and this is so true of my previous lives as a lawyer or a scientist as well, my general rule is, if someone else can do this, why do I do it? Like, in terms of, if someone else can do it and better than me, if I don't come to work that day and everything goes on just the same, then I don't really need to be there at all. So that was true in being a cog in the bigger wheel of the law.
Yeah.
I didn't really feel like I had any kind of, like, responsibility, like, really, honestly, responsibility.
Honestly, yeah.
When it comes to the Nike ad, same thing. It's like, yeah, I'll do my version, but whether it gets made or not,
yeah.
isn't contingent.
It's still going to be a tick and it's still going to be a shoe. Yeah.
So when it's authorial, like, when you've got your thing and it also has meaning to you, so it's part of your image system, your moral system, your belief system, your kind of impulse to communicate, then it's important to you to make, you know, that story yours and to make it something that only you can do and that your version has value. When it comes to something like Fell, like, even people say, oh, you're a director, why didn't you direct it? It's like, well, because Casper directed better.
Yeah.
And I wrote it for him to direct. I didn't write it in the world and find a director. I wrote this for him.
Yeah.
Like, it was the collaboration I saw it. And my version would be different, but it wouldn't be better, so he should direct it. Like, that's you know.
That simple.
It's that simple.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to always look for what I want to do. I just know when I come across this project, is this something that really requires me in any way to be true, to be real, to be relevant, to be important? And if not, then I'll just pass and look for something else.
Can we talk about the relationship with, I don't...
Casimir Burgess.
Casimir.
Yep.
He was the filmmaker for Lily that won the Berlinale, the Crystal Bear.
Berlin Film Festival, yeah.
Last year?
No, it was 2011 or 12.
Yeah. So,
I think it's 12.
How did you guys end up working together?
I chased him, hunted him down pretty much, as inelegant as that. look, I think I'm pretty picky about everything, as you might have gauged. And when I admire really hard and really well, but I don't admire easily.
Yeah.
And I saw Cass's work. Actually, in this very cinema here at the Astor, we were screening often together. Our short films were in various competitions, and his film at this time was Booth Story, and I just loved it. I just said, "Who made that?" He was on my radar. Then I kept following his other films, and made sure it wasn't just an accident that he'd made this really awesome thing and nothing else. And we kept bumping into each other in sort of Melbourne's tiniest film circles, and we had mutual collaborators. Actually, we ended up, by accidentally, having a lot of collaborators in common, even though we just chose the same sort of people.
Yeah.
And this is way before Lily, you know, and I just said, I want to write that guy's feature because he's not really a writer. I mean, he can, but he wasn't necessarily a writer, and I wanted to write something for him. So we had a meeting, and I just pitched him the idea that, you know, I said, why don't you write your own films? And he said, why haven't you done a feature? And he said, well, I can't really pay a writer. Like, I mean, you know, as a director, it's really tough. I don't necessarily want to write my own film, but what choice do you have? And I said, well, I'll write it for you. I said, I'll write you your first feature. And he's like, maybe. He wasn't sure.
I'd be like, yes.
Well, no, he's kind of like, well, let's just see if this works. Like, enough. I mean, let's make sure, because it was kind of like matchmaking, you know. So we sort of dated, you know, creatively speaking. We had coffees and we talked about films we liked in common, and wanted to see if there was a meeting of the minds or something that we could kind of, because we both also have quite, like we were talking before about intuitive versus rational. Cass and I both love two different types of films. On the one hand, kind of really hard-hitting, authentic, what does it mean to be a human being, unflinching. On the other hand, really whimsical, beautiful, aspirational work. And they're completely opposite. And we had to try and figure out what our common worldview was that we could spring something integrated from. And until we could find that, it's just an arbitrary thing to say, I'll write you a film, because we didn't have anything to kind of like connect to yet. And we just started from that basis, and we kept sort of, you watch this movie, I watch this movie, we'll talk, you know, did you like this? And we found we had heaps and heaps aesthetically in common. And then we started going through premises, you know, what could it be about? And he had a lookbook of his past kind of ideas, I had mine. I said, no, I want to interrogate you. I want to like kind of cross-examine, you know, psychoanalyze you. I want you to find the thing you don't know yet you want to say. Like, my job here is an interpreter. I want to like, you know, decommission yourself and like pull out your story you don't even know that we're right yet. And we went through his like book, and we came up with one premise that I didn't like a lot of them, like in terms of they didn't respond. They're great, but they're not my, I couldn't connect. And there was one that I kind of connected to, and there was like one line, and it's nothing like the film actually, as it turns out. But it was enough to kind of
the starting
to
point.
Start you know, and then from there it was just magic.
So in terms of premises, it says on your website that you tell universal human stories. Does that need to be true about the premise for each of the things that you work on, that there's something?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I mean, I think that's the only thing that kind of keeps us interested. And look at the videos I do as well. Like, I've always admired videos. I mean, admire is probably strong, but, like, I can see a lot of value and enjoy a lot of videos that don't do those things. Like, I go, oh, that's a spectacle. I like that. Or look at that really beautiful piece. But I could never be able to do it myself. I just can't seem to invest. I have to always go for an emotional connection or try and reveal something true about what it means to be human. Otherwise, again, I just don't know what the purpose is. It just becomes a waste of resources. Or also just feel like I can't do it. I'm just faking it. And Fel is all that. Fel is all, like, human. I mean, there's nothing but what it means to be a human being in that movie. Yeah.
And so Fel was under the Stark Raving Productions
No. Stark Raving's kind of like, it's not really a, I mean, it's not really a production company. It's something kind of misleading about a website sometimes. Yeah. People will call up and go, how can I speak to someone from Stark Raving? I'm like,
hang on, let me get her. Our research assistant.
But what I mean, it is a company, you know. I kind of used it as a way to kind of keep some separation between me and certain, like, branding, as you said, like, you know. But Stark Raving certainly was not at all. I was just Natasha Pinkus on that one. Felix Media, John Maynard, Mary Minnis produced the film.
Yeah.
Oh, Mary's great. I've worked with Mary. Oh, just on a show. Yeah.
There you go. Small world. Yeah. So, but that was under the Felix.
So how much time do you spend with the Stark Raving? Is it something that's just here and there, or do you tend to...
Stark Raving is just a landing page for my music video work, really.
Gotcha.
Just to make it feel... Yeah. I mean, there's no company. There's no sort of ensemble. I mean, Warwick... My partner Warwick works as a cinematographer on my projects, but he also helps so much, as you know, in the Stark Raving things, like all the technical shit, but mostly as my partner rather than as any kind of, like, you know, employee or anything like that.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I guess the question behind that question is: are you 9 to 5, or you've said somewhere you work 100 hours a week? You know, are you a full-time creative person, or do you need to supplement that with other
roles? It's taken a long time to get to that point. I do have a need to supplement with other things. I don't supplement with other things. I used to teach. I taught law at Monash for 5 years as I was transitioning from a professional person to a creative professional. And it was kind of a good arrangement because it was a couple of days a week, and it was maximum income for minimum hours. And then gradually I peeled that back until eventually I stepped off fully into this creative life. I don't know how long I can do it for. I don't know how sustainable it is. And in fact, I don't know about the Gautier video in general, but, like, because I mean, I probably couldn't have kept going financially if it wasn't for Fel happening that year and all those other things. So it's really tough financially to be that person. But no, Stark Raving, you know, like, I've often thought about, a few years ago someone said to me, okay, so you've got all this, you know, high-profile music video, why don't you put some money into building the company and you can make 20 videos a year and make, these are the kind of differences you can make per project and blah, 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 blah. And I looked into it and went, I don't understand what would be the benefit other than more videos. Like, for example, I might have 100 units of creativity a year, right, in terms of just, like, if you look at it that way.
Yeah.
And if I have four outlets, then they each get 25. But if I have 20 projects, they now get 5 each. So they're all going to get shit.
Right? I just love how quickly you switch from creative out there.
Completely inspirational.
There's so many units of creativity that I have.
No, but I'm just trying to, like...
Yes, the person who's inspired by light falling on a window.
Also, it's like...
100 units. 4 hours.
Because what's happening in that moment, I feel something that's, like, really hard to describe.
Yeah.
And then I have to quickly translate into something like that can be shared between humans.
That's right.
But to me, all I could feel at that point was a feeling. And it's just kind of like this feeling of, like, more doesn't necessarily mean better. And there's this human impulse towards, and that's why we're in this population crisis and environmental collapse, which is like, let's just have more of everything. It's like, you know what? Yeah. Restraint is very, very useful for everybody. Like, you know, like, let's just all just put the foot on the brake a minute. And I kind of went, I would love the environment of a company and people around and socially, rather than the isolation of the creative life.
Yep.
But pragmatically, I just didn't really see what the world needed from that, or even what I would possibly
gain from it
in any way.
So whether you're being completely intuitive or completely rational, you do seem very goal-driven.
Really? That's a great thing to hear.
Yeah, you do.
I feel like I'm floating around most of the time.
Well, my next question was, do you have any advice to share on the idea of setting goals?
Yeah, y'all should get some. God, man, I think that is a problem. I actually had this conversation last night with my cousin slash sister figure slash best friend. That was just, you know, three different casting notes in one character
screen. Yeah, I just went, well, okay. Yeah.
No, we're talking about, like, we must have some
sort of...
What
type is she?
Exactly. She's gorgeous. We were talking about, like, this sort of, I guess it's a mortality fear, the goal-setting thing. Common to both her and I. We both fear the future, or at least don't plan. You know, as people have five-year plans and 10-year plans. Yeah. I've never had a five-minute plan. In fact, how's this going? Is this going to be 5 minutes? you know, because I think that's linked in some way to kind of a momentary realization about how little time we have, let alone left. So I don't have goals, and I feel like that's a problem. I actually feel like I could do a little better with having some. And I don't just mean project-based. I mean, let's have a holiday in December type goals. Like some sort of... See, the problem is, like, you go through life, especially adolescence, with all these landmarks that are already fixed, like finish school or get through puberty or go to uni or finish uni. These things which are already, like, heaps of them within quick succession until the age of 17 or 22 if you go to uni. And thereafter, it's just the abyss. I mean, you're pretty much then in this kind of, like, you know, figure out sport.
Yeah.
And we make up landmarks, like have baby or make marriage, buy a house.
Yeah.
But turn 30, turn 40.
But they happen to you. You're not actually doing them, right?
Yeah.
I figured that out.
Yeah.
That's bad. It happens real fast. But, like, the issue is, like, how do you navigate the rest of your life without any kind of, like, you know, kind of fixed poles
goalposts
to slam them with? It's kind of tough. So the best thing you can do is try to articulate that time with some sort of, like a structure, like writing a screenplay, like try to find some sort of things to hold on to. And in the absence of that, which I'm currently in the absence, I feel like I'm not orbiting anything. I'm a little bit free-falling, and that can be really, really discombobulating.
Do you ever feel disillusioned by the industry and what frig am I doing?
Of course. Most of the time.
Most of the time?
Yeah.
Well, how do you get over that? What's the drive?
Well, I was reading today, actually, about the difference between... what was it? It was about meaning.
Yep.
And that people say meaning and purpose are the same thing, but they're totally different.
Yep.
I mean, purpose is something to me like quite external. Like it's like, you know, I want to clean the toilet or I want to achieve this in my career. But meaning might have nothing to do with actions or outcomes. It's just about something in your guts. So I think sometimes when you feel a bit disillusioned about the industry at large, you're really talking about those moments when maybe you're questioning whether it's giving you that sense of meaning anymore, even if there's purpose. Like, I can find purpose in... I mean, these whole things are great distractors. It's like, I want to do a music video because during that month I'm doing it. I'm not thinking about how meaningless it feels. I'm just kind of pursuing goal, and it helps me get through the day, and I kind of feel like there's a tangibleness around what I'm doing. But doesn't necessarily... But occasionally through that sort of cloud of distraction, you can get these kind of moments of where crack through this sort of fear that perhaps there's something better you could be doing with your time and energy and stuff you're sacrificing could have a greater outcome, which of course is fraught because what does greater mean anyway, right? It's obviously something you're overlaying onto it and maybe that's an ego thing.
Okay.
You think, oh, I've got more to offer. I should be saving dogs and stuff because I love dogs. So I'd love to save dogs. And I feel sometimes guilt about the indulgence of art. I think in a meta level, of course, it's important, and I don't doubt for a second that art is not just for civilized but uncivilized societies. We need it to reflect on ourselves and to give ourselves greater spiritual understanding and meaning. But do I need to be doing it? Like, is there something else with my middle class white Anglo background that I could be contributing beside telling more goddamn stories? And that plagues me like anything. Like it hurts, especially when there's such a long journey between the inception moment and the outcome, and that journey is up in the air, whether or not it even happens. Look, the first script I wrote was like 12 years ago. It took this long before my first film hit the screens. And if I'd known then it was going to take that long, would I continue? I don't know. If I'd put that 10,000 hours into saving dogs, I think about 10,000 faces would probably be looking back at me, and I hate that.
Yeah.
I find that really hard. And I don't know if that's going to keep me from continuing it forever, to be honest, until I can start to understand that relationship.
Well, you seem like someone who will, as soon as she feels like it's not the right thing to do, move on to something else that she finds.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think I would wish I could, in a way. I think I had that strength in me maybe when I was younger, I think. I don't know. I think I'm too fearful.
Right.
If I'm honest with you. But you get so far down the rabbit hole that it becomes a new normal, and you just learn how to rest there. And, you know, I'm doing what I can with everything I can, but sometimes I do think you know, is this it? And then what? And then what? You know, if you think of goals, once I've made Clive, which I think in some ways my unconscious goal is just to get my film, my film, just get it there. Then what?
There'll be another goal, I'm sure.
If we didn't have that uncertainty, what would be the point?
Yeah, right. Without ambiguity, I mean, how boring is an answer, right?
Yeah.
It just becomes a really short joke. Mm. Yeah, look, I think that's fair.
And surely as long as you're being as truthful and committed to something as you can be,
yeah,
and following things through, then wherever that takes you at the end of that is the answer for where to go next.
Exactly. You can't exactly plot. People always say, you know, what am I going to do in 5 years' time? And I think by the time you're three quarters of the way down the road, the rest of the road looks different. Mm. I mean, how can you imagine what you're going to do in the last 25% of your journey when you're at the first bit because you haven't yet seen all those kind of like detours and stuff along the way, right? So I think that's kind of true. I think at the moment, one of the things I grapple with is I'm still trying to find joy in it now. I think satisfaction and joy are different and people confuse them. I do find it satisfying, but I don't find it very joyful right now. I'm finding it harder and harder to derive joy out of it. I get moments of joy, but I don't think, to be honest, not that everything has to be joyful as well.
Yeah,
but there has to be something in there that's at least, I'll put it this way, I can find a lot of joy in the world and in my moments. I'm perfectly happy. I'm very simple. I like just sitting in the sun with mum and dad and having a cup of tea. Yeah. I'm perfectly happy. Yeah. Why do I have to make things much more complex for myself, you know, and solve all of the world's problems in a deep, dark room on my own when they're around the corner? Do I have to deprive myself?
Yeah.
I don't find writing joyful. I don't find rewriting at all joyful. I don't find any of it really joyful.
But we wouldn't have great art if people just went, hey, you know, sitting with... I love having a tea with my mum and dad too, but we probably wouldn't go into the places that we need to create great art then, would
yeah,
we, if we
no,
stayed
right.
there.
We wouldn't have anything great if we didn't have to work for it.
Yeah.
What's up with the work? I love work. I love work. I actually do. I enjoy it. I like sweeping up leaves. I like physical work. I love it all. I mean, I love bringing firewood up the stairs and I like, you know, working through the night.
Back in your body as well, that stuff.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. It's not the work of it. I think what I find not joyful about the creative process is how necessary it is to be alone. And I don't mean like physically, I mean in the world. In those moments you are like necessarily commenting on something you can't participate, and it's like you've been told to go to bed early and everyone else is having a party downstairs, and it's just like, it feels like suffering. You know, I find that really hard. And I also find it hard to confront some of the things I more comfortably would like to repress and not have to deal with and excavate every single moment of every day. So, yeah, I find it necessary rather than joyful. And also, I find it disheartening to see very few examples of anyone who came through this process intact. Like, if you think about it, everyone who goes down this rabbit hole pretty much stays there or falls out the bottom of it. So it's also really hard not to find models for safe practice of your craft. And these are the things that, at this point in my career, I'm finding the biggest challenges. Don't mean to be dark and miserable, but just poo.
No, it's so interesting. And I think, you know, in different ways, these are questions that we all have to deal with.
Mm.
I always talk to people about the circle that you go around, whether you're an artist or wherever you work. And at some point in the circle, you're inspired and you're driven and you're really happy. But to get to that point, you have to go down to come back up. And when you're down, that bit is amazing too, because the things that you learn help you in the next rotation. Wow, it's all getting a bit deep.
Be inspired and stuff.
For the people who are starting out, who are 4 years old and have a Kodak camera that's probably now an iPhone or something, not a Kodak at all, who do see a random person on the street and are inspired by that, are there any words of wisdom that you would give to them?
Yeah, I think I probably should qualify a little of what I said in the sense that, like, finishing on that note wouldn't be complete in that way, because I think despite all of that, like, go forth with open eyes and know that's sort of possibly waiting for you. But what I would say is, like, an unexamined life is just not really a life, and that means examining your own self as well as every single possible thing around you in every possible detail you can handle it, because truly that's so enriching. And sometimes having that four-year-old, being that four-year-old, having that camera in your hand, all that is a vehicle, you know. It's just a vessel into accessing that perspective. So whatever it is for you, whether it's camera, whether it's a pen, or whether it's, you know, your fandangled piece of machinery, whatever it helps you to remember to live presently and in gratitude, can only be a good thing. ultimately.
Natasha, you are an intense freight train of emotion and turn of phrase. That's the only way I can describe you. All right, this has been an amazing hour.
This has been a fantastic hour. I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight.
I feel like I've been slapped in the face with knowledge. and it's a nice
better
way to finish.
Better than a dead fish.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. Better than a dead fish. Thanks, Natasha, for your
time. Thank you so
much. Pleasure. Thank you.
Lauren, I've got a takeout for you. You ready for this? This idea of saying no until you're convinced to say yes with projects. Because, you know, so many projects come in front of your path and sometimes you have a tendency, especially I do, to say yes.
Oh, I say yes to everything.
Everything, right?
And then I...
And then you get halfway through the project and you go, where's my passion for this right now? And you're never going to create great work if that's the case, I feel, personally. So this idea of saying no until I can be convinced both internally and externally to say yes is so important.
I think you're 100% right.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved about talking to Natasha is she's so driven and has such a high standard. She has to prove to herself 100% the validity project of an idea. Yeah. Of
well, having that conviction to do it too.
And not only the other person convincing you, but finding the reasons within yourself.
Within yourself.
Like that's the start of the artistic process. Oh, I don't know. What are the starts? There are probably a million starts. For me, something I really loved about that interview was all of the contradictions.
Yeah, yes. I love it. Yeah.
Which is what art is like.
Yes.
One moment, come out of a film and I think, oh, I thought that. And then someone else will say, will change your perspective. Mm. Oh, I thought this about it. You're like, oh, that's right too. Can come at what we do from so many angles.
Yeah.
And completely believe something in one moment to have it ripped out of your heart and exposed to you in another moment.
Yeah.
And finding the truth in all of that is what counts. So that was pretty fantastic.
I don't even know how to put that into words. I mean, I would love to hear Natasha's summary of that. You know, I reckon.
But she wouldn't tell us because it'd require 200 words or something.
But I just love her energy. Hasn't she got a beautiful energy?
Yeah, she's fantastic. So down to earth, and we covered it in the wrap up. But this relentless investigation, just. The way she attacks things, it's fantastic.
Relentless investigation. And we had some food with her after where we talked for another couple of hours and it could have been another podcast.
We could have recorded at least two more podcasts for you guys. I met a listener of our podcast at an event this month. It was really great talking to him about what he's been enjoying about the podcast. And he was really keen to hear how I'm going with organising my schedule now that I'm pretty much reliant on myself. And I feel like I'll be better able to speak to this in the coming months. At the moment, I feel like I'm only just feeling my way into it. But I have got some really exciting things happening. Yeah. I'm starting rehearsals tomorrow with Complete Works, who I'm touring Summer of the 17th Doll with this month.
Great.
As Olive, which is a role I'm reprising from last year. Such an amazing opportunity to get to work on a really great role a second time over. I really am so excited about, you know, it's not 8 months of work like Q44 have done, but it is that same thing of having the time to delve deeper and find another level. So working with Complete Works, that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. I'm also catching up with Adam this month to go into Adam a Cass. Rewrite of This Is What It Feels Like.
Wow.
Our show that was on at La Mama earlier this year. You know, we've talked about how we're going to approach the rewrite.
That's do you have clear direction personally on what you want to do to that at this point? Or is
We've got a couple of things we're focusing on. And it was really interesting talking to Natasha the other night after we finished the interview and finding out how she's talking to her about how she's approaching her rewrite for Clive. The screenplay that, you know, she shopped around LA that got blacklisted.
Yes.
And we were asking about the difference between that and the one that she'll write now.
Yeah, the script versus the script that she actually wants to get shot, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I'd never thought about it like this. I know this is a film script and we're working on a play script, but I had still never thought about this idea of your initial script, you write all the emotional content into so that the people who are reading it can see it in their heads. But then when you rewrite it, you change it so that obviously it's something you would shoot. What else is happening? I caught up with Anita Quayle recently.
Yeah, Anita.
And I just wanted to mention that she's currently touring doing in Germany with the Quail Project. And apparently she's got a blog for the trip. She's over there for 5 weeks.
Can we put that on our website?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have to find out what that is. What about you, Nick? I'm sure you've got a million projects lined up.
Yeah. I really believe this month it's huge. It's another level on what was this month, really. But I'm ready to, and I want to talk about ownership in the moment really quickly and just talk about this idea of sometimes you're going to be busy and sometimes it's about saying chin up and shoulders back. Getting out there, stop saying I'm not ready for this and just doing. I'm in a great headspace.
Do you feel like you have been doing that? Telling yourself you're not ready for it? Like, is that a...
I think I do. I go, am I ready for this?
Have I done enough? Do more work.
Sometimes you need to just run into it head first. Trust yourself that you've done the work and just, you know, as I said, chin up and shoulders back. So first thing I did is bought myself a beautiful camera so I can record self-tests. Because, you know, sometimes you'll get it from your agent and they'll say, okay, we need a self-test in 2 days. And your first thing is, number one, wow, I got to get this character together. But the second one is,
who the heck is
going to shoot it? So yeah. I'm looking forward to taking that sort of out of my thinking and using my camera. I look forward to helping other people with their self-tests too. I think that's a beautiful thing, is that if I've got this camera, I might as well be sharing it as well. The other thing is, I've just scored a radio gig for Kiss FM in Melbourne with two of my friends, Scott O'Halloran and Rebecca Johanbury. And I'm really looking forward because the live element brings a whole nother kettle of fish. Knowing that things are going out in the airwaves is just mind-blowing sometimes, especially when things are coming out of your mouth.
So this, in a way, has kind of been good practice.
Great practice.
Our listeners may not be aware, but we're actually refining our process every month and trying to edit less and just see what happens in the moment and go with it.
And that's part of the fun. I'm not going anywhere with this podcast. I love it too much. But that is going to happen, the radio show. I'm up to Taree to do an MC gig as well, which for the Manning Valley Business Awards, which is a bit of fun. Another string to the bow, you know, nice. The MCing thing. And then guess what? I'm off to Turkey for my corporate job, show calling, which is pretty much like TV directing, I guess, but taking content, producing it for the client, and then in live setting, making it happen. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be huge.
Well, that sounds like it'll be a really interesting month, Nick, because last month you said how quiet you were going to be, and then all these things came in on top of it. So, you know, we're looking at the month ahead, and it already seems pretty jam-packed, and I'm sure other things are going to float into the schedule.
And I got another TVC as well. So, you know, hey, there's more there. So there's plenty to do. So that's our months, Lauren.
Do we have any recommendations for this month?
Yeah, I do. Do you want to go first? Have you got something that you want to share?
I need to look into this a bit, and I'll put some info on the website. Dave Harrison in Sydney is co-artistic director, I believe, of a new initiative called The King's Collective, who are doing some work up there, and I think they're one to watch. So we'll mention them more possibly in next month's podcast.
They've got Facebook too, aren't they? I think I've just liked them on Facebook.
They've definitely got Facebook.
Go seek them out and follow them, because I think I agree with you. I think that's going to be a good little project. Yeah. I have some reviews for you, Lauren, and the first thing I want to cover off on is, by the time this goes live, it will be, do you know NAIDOC Week?
What is NAIDOC Week?
It stands for National Aborigines and Islanders Day Observance Committee, which now, I think it was originally just one day, but it's now turned into a week celebrating Indigenous culture in Australia.
Fantastic.
And I have to give a little quick shout out to one of the interns at work, Douglas Briggs, who was just named Mr. Young NAIDOC, which is a fantastic piece of recognition for him.
Yeah.
He'll be going around talking. He's talking to Parliament as well. So he's got a really beautiful, beautiful opportunity. And he's one of the brightest and most well-spoken lads I know. So it is so well-deserved. So I wanted to give him a little shout-out.
Are there artistic events happening? Is it throughout Australia? How can we get involved?
Certainly. There's a bit of a shout-out that I want to give.
Yeah.
There is a festival going on called the Bagot Festival, which is a part of the Darwin Festival, which is happening between the 7th of August to the 24th of August. As a part of this festival, there is a thing called Yarning in the Trees Speaker Series. It's basically giving Darwin local residents an opportunity to hear from some of the elders of the community in Darwin and basically hear and discover their diverse perspectives on Darwin life. And there's a couple of them going on. I just think it would be beautiful to hear some of these.
Wow, when you're in Turkey, is there any way we can get to Darwin?
Oh, I know. Tell me about it. Look, if you're up in Darwin, go and have a look and watch out for Douglas Briggs too.
That sounds like such an amazing experience.
So I think there's some beautiful things. NAIDOC Week is happening nationally, so don't think it's just Darwin. Next week, please go and seek it out.
And we'll, of course, put a link up on our site so you can look into it.
Been quite a cultural podcast, hasn't it, Lauren? It's been good.
It has. It's been great.
Is that it?
Well, I think that's it. It's been lovely catching up with you, Nick.
Same, Lauren.
Look forward to seeing you again next month.
Yes.
In the meantime, our listeners can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us Relentless emails.
At SoundCloud.
Theactofstorytelling@gmail.com. Stream us on SoundCloud.
Yep.
And please, if you have suggestions for us, for things you'd like us to cover, questions for us, anyone you'd like us to interview, please, please, please feel free to PM us on Facebook or send us an email at theactofstorytelling@gmail.com.
And review us on iTunes, please, please, please. It helps us get noticed. And we'll tell you all about our new storyteller very, very soon. We're very excited about the possibility of the next storyteller. Yep. So we'll keep that tight-lipped, but watch out for it.
Thanks for listening, guys.